You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 67.
AI is likely to be either the best or worst thing to happen to humanity. Stephen Hawking.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Before we get started, guys, I set up a special link to help people affected by the coronavirus, and you can donate to Feed America. There is a lot of people in need out there, and Feed America is a great organization, and they're helping millions of people on a daily basis, and they also need your help. If you want to donate, even $5, $10, it goes a long way. Head over to indiefilmhustle.com/help. Now, guys, today I cannot be more excited about the show. We have on the show today filmmaker Mark Toya, who is the creator behind the insane indie sci-fi action film Monsters of Man. Now, what makes this film so unique, and it's not only the way they made it, because he was able to make this film for under $2 million, but when you see the trailer, you will understand what he's been able to do. The quality of the production is at least a $50 to $100 million tentpole style film for a fraction of the cost. Now, where the story really becomes interesting is that Mark was offered multiple seven-figure deals by traditional distribution companies and sales agents, and he decided to say no to all of them. The reason why is that he picked up a little book called Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, and when he read that book and started to dive deep down the indie film hustle rabbit hole, he decided, I'm going to just self-distribute this as an experiment. He is in a position to experiment with his million-dollar plus film to see if he can actually get an ROI with his amazing film. And he reached out to me months ago, and we've been talking back and forth. When I saw the trailer for the film, my mouth fell on the floor. I almost fell out of my chair, and I just recently watched the film, and I got to tell you, it is one of the best films I've seen in 2020, without question. What he was able to achieve with his budget and his just limitations was remarkable. And the visual effects alone, which he has over 2,000 visual effect shots in the movie, I mean, what he was able to do, I mean, we're talking studio level visual effects, not just like a one or two shots, the entire film. These robots are the star of the show, and these killer robots there. And you'll understand once you'll understand what the movie's about when we start talking about it. But these robots are the stars. And I'm really curious, as he is, to see what happens with the self-distribution. Now, he's already launched an Indiegogo campaign to help him pay for the marketing of, you know, buying Facebook ads and things like that. And within a few, I think within 2 or 3 days, he was already at 150% funded, and it's just starting. So I'm really excited to have Mark on, and we're going to talk all about how he made the film, why he turned down, and specifically why he turned down these multi-million dollar deals for his film, and how the filmtrepreneur method has really changed his mentality about how movies can be made. So without any further ado, please enjoy my inspiring conversation with Mark Toya. I'd like to welcome to the show Mark Toya. How you doing, Mark?
I'm very good, thank you.
Oh my, I'm so excited to have you on the show. We've been talking for a while now. So can you tell the audience how we were even introduced, how you came into my life and how I came into yours, sir?
With what I remember, I was actually nursing a broken rib, maybe. I'm not sure. I was on a mountain skiing at the time. Mm-hmm. And I had injured myself a little bit, so I thought I'd just sit in there in the hotel room, and I was just fumbling through looking at how to sell a movie. And your podcast popped up, and it was so interesting that I really dug deep into all of your shows, and a lot of it was making so much sense. And at the time, I was going through a large sales company in the States and go through the whole distribution thing, and all of a sudden you popped up just to upset and flip everything on its ear.
As you do, and
I thought, you know what, there's an alternate way to doing this, and I'm not saying the traditional way is the right way or the wrong way, and this way that I'm going to go is the right way or wrong way, but I tend to like this way because I've got more control.
Right,
and I'm a bit of a control freak.
Yeah, and then you read the book. You read my book, Rise of the Filmtrepreneur. You sent it over to a few people who worked on the film as well. And
yes, I've read it around a lot. I mean, I've told people, go and buy your audio book.
Yeah, you're responsible for most of my sales in Australia. You're responsible for most of my sales in Australia, so I appreciate that. No, so you reached out to me and we started talking about it, and you were kind of explaining what you were going to do with your film Monsters of Man, and I get hit up all the time by filmmakers like, hey, I got this film, you know, I'm thinking of self-distributing, you know, can you take a look at it? And I get hit up all the time. So you sent me this trailer. I looked at it. I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, and this was, we're going back, 6 months at least? It's been a while.
Might have been 12 months now, yeah.
We've been talking for a while. And that's, I was good. Like, yeah. What is this? And then as I called, you know, I was like, we have to get on a Skype. So we started talking. And then you said, oh, I read your book and I'm thinking I want to go down this road. And I'm like, oh, man. And then I started digging into the movie and what you did and how you did it and all that stuff, which we're going to get to in a minute. But before we get into Monsters of Man, tell the audience a little bit about who you are and how did you get into the business?
The business of commercial advertising or the business of filmmaking?
Filmmaking in general, because I consider commercial advertising very much like Mr. Ridley Scott, Tony Scott, David Fincher, Michael Bay. They all started off in commercials. That is filmmaking, but just for commercials as opposed to narrative. So can you tell us how you got into the business?
It was a bit of a weird one, actually. I was a steel worker originally. I was in Australia. We call them boilermakers. We literally built buildings and anything made of steel. But I was always a very artistic child. So I was one of those very lucky kids that could paint real life oils when he was 13 years old. Like, I was gifted artist, child artist. So, but that sort of didn't really go anywhere due to my teacher telling me that art doesn't pay, and there's a video floating around about that as well. So I end up doing a trade with my father, and who got me the job, and I became a boilermaker. But I got into photography at a bit of a late age, to be honest. And I took a photo of a yacht because I was into yacht racing at the time. And I sent the yacht off this image off to a magazine, and they sent me $50. Which I remember looking at that check going, "Oh, they pay you for this?" It was so easy, right? And then I did it again, and another check turned up for like $200, and then the machine just, my head exploded and off I went. So, yeah, after I did that for a few years, I sort of climbed the ranks doing, magazine photography and news photography quite swiftly, and it became quite lucrative. I sort of gave up my day job and then got into photography full-blown, and then I had a client of mine ask me to do a TV commercial. And I had no idea what I was doing. I literally paid a guy a carton of beer to teach me how to turn a video camera on, and I was hooked. And, I did this commercial for this client, one of our clients, and it won Best Director and Best Cinematographer first time out in an awards show, and I thought, this is for me, and that's how I got into it. So,
and you've –
25 years ago now.
So you've shot a couple of commercials, basically, is what you're telling me. You've shot a few.
Very early days, yes. No, well, I shot one, really.
No. And I'm talking about throughout your career. You've shot a few commercials.
I've shot thousands of commercials now. But the business has been very good to me. I've traveled the world countless times, and I've made my living doing that. And my wife and I, we sort of run a small property business as well, and we've sort of combined our brains and to a point to where I could literally go and make myself a movie without sort of begging for money around the traps or using state funding money or film funding money. And I've got a very supportive wife, and I said, I want to make a film. And she goes, well, go and make a film. And I didn't get barraged by it, you know what I mean?
So no.
That kept me creatively free to do whatever I want. And another thing she said as well, she goes, I want you to just have creative freedom to just do what you want with the film, because it's what happens when you got a small amount of money, you got to try and make it work. But if you've got a lot of people telling you what to do, it tends to be quite messy, because there's a lot of other people as invested in that film, and there's a lot of stress and annoyance, and you're not sure if you're going to be able to pay that person back and blah, blah, blah.
And politics and all that kind of stuff.
It's completely stress-free exercise. And we're in a position to really not stress about it, the money side of making the movie either. So I was in a part of my life where I was ready for it.
For the experiment. And an experiment it is, as we will continue to reveal in this episode. Now, tell me how Monsters of Man came to be. Like, how did the story come about? And what was the budget? How did you decide to, like, hey, you know what? I'm just going to go make this insane movie.
It was a very random story. I've got a couple of other screenplays that I was really keen on doing. But one of them was multi-country. This one here we shot in multiple countries as well, but this one was extra multi-country. It was quite a large film, not crazy large, but I wanted to do this particular other movie first. It's called UFO Man. It's pretty intense. Actually, it's my favorite sort of screenplay that we have at the moment. But this particular film, Monsters of Man, it was originally called Robot 4. It was just a working title, but I thought about it in the back of a van in Vietnam. I was traveling around in Vietnam. We're doing a film shoot with a friend of mine, and not a film shoot, a TV commercial. And as we were driving around the van, bored, traveling up and down this country, he said, "Oh, I'd love to do a movie with you, Mark. I'd like to invest in a movie with you." And I said, "Oh, yeah, okay, great, let's do it." So. we started thinking of ideas in the van. Anyway, he wanted to do this Treasure Island thing, and I went, "No, I don't know. I sort of want to do something a bit crazy sci-fi action, Oh, no, but Treasure Island. And I go, anyway, so I sort of sadly dominated the idea train. But you know, he's a really lovely guy. Zip, his name is. He owns a bar actually in Vietnam called Apocalypse Now.
Genius.
The guy's a real film buff. He's got his own production company. He's done very well, and he's a really good friend of mine. Anyway, so he wants to invest in the film. He doesn't end up. Oh, he puts a little bit tiny little bit at the end, but you know, he things change for him, so he didn't really jump into the film by the end. But you know, I literally thought of this whole concept in this van, and then I sort of came back and started writing down notes and beat passes for it. And I've got a really good screenwriter that I love working with, Jeff Hand, and we sort of worked with it together. And he sort of put the guts of it together, and then it sort of came back to me for notes. But I ended up literally not rewriting it, but just going through the whole thing myself. And I think he might have been a little bit annoyed with me because I went, "That's it, it's done. Two drafts, you know." and he's like, "Oh, you're crazy." And then I go, "Oh, you know, it's my money. I can do whatever I want." So, and we ended up literally with a 167-page script, which was ridiculous.
Obviously.
And I thought, you know what, screw it. I'm going to shoot the whole 167 pages. And because, again, I could afford to do it. So we went and did it. But the good thing about it is when you see the film, there is no padding, like seriously. You know, a lot of movies, they sit there and they just.
Well, what's the runtime?
It's just over 2 hours.
Okay.
But it's, you know, 167 should have been like a, you know, a Chris Nolan epic, right? You know, but it's good because we've got no padding in the movie. It is literally once we set up our characters, it is away. And that's where a lot of people that have watched the film, a lot of test audiences and people that have seen it are all quite shocked with how intense this film is right to the very end. And, you know, you'll see when it comes out.
Do you mind talking about the budget, or do you want to keep that under wraps?
Yeah, I'll keep it under wraps because it's okay.
Under 25 million.
But look, it's under 2 million, yes.
Okay, under $2 million. All right.
That's real cash, not pretend cash or soft money. That's like real cash. If you want to put my time into it, who knows?
Oh, no, of course. So if it's, but the film looks. The film looks like it's something that costs $100 million. I mean, it the quality, which I would expect from somebody with your skill set. I mean, you've shot thousands and thousands of commercials over the course of your career, and you know the tools so well. I mean, it's the same, you know, same school as Ridley and Tony and Fincher and Bay and Fuqua. Those guys just shot so much by the time they got to features. Well, I'm like, well, we know the tools. Now let's just tell a cool story. And you also kind of know how to squeeze the most bang out of your buck, essentially, because that's what you've done with this, because the visual effects are pretty insane in this film.
Yeah, we've been very fortunate. The ad game does teach you lots of tricks, and because you've got varied budgets, you know, you might have an ad that you're doing for like $5 or $6 million, and then the next day you're doing a commercial for $20,000. So, oh, maybe not these days, but, you know, it's sort of like a the advertising game is a great learning tool for feature films, but more so because the bigger your commercial, the more pressure you have from, you know, agencies and lawyers and, you know, creatives and clients and all that. You might have 20 people in a tent, you know, all with their own monitors telling you what they want from it. So, you know, understanding time, pressure, money on these big commercial shoots makes making a movie so easy. Like, making the film was boring. Process actually, because I had no pressure behind me. You know, there was no one breathing down my neck telling me how to shoot, and no one telling me how to direct, and no one telling me that someone is speaking wrong.
And the bottle is not being shot properly, needs to be lit better or something like that. Make the logo pop or something along those lines.
It's fine, you know, because that's the client's their job, you know.
Of course.
It's their project. It's their skin in the game. It's their job on the line. So I have no problem with clients telling me what they want because it is their money and their job. And I will respect that to the day I'm dead. But you know, from a movie's perspective, for this particular project, it was great. It literally took me 2 weeks to stop looking behind me. You know, thinking there was someone had better tell me I'm doing it wrong, right? But it was such a relaxed, stress-free, beautiful experience. And people go, "Oh no, they're so stressful making movies." I go, "I'm not sure what you're doing, but I had such a lovely time. It was literally like, it was just like therapy. I used it like a 2 month. My wife said it was like a holiday for you, right? Every time she visited us in Cambodia, you know, I've got a beer in my mouth and I've got ladies, you know, giving me leg massages and, you know, because we're in Cambodia. So.
But I think also, and I'll use myself as an example where, I mean, I've shot for clients and then I've shot my own features. And when I shoot my own features, I basically am the only person that I have to worry about. And I, other than the stress of just trying to do it for the budget and that kind of stress, but not having a client behind you, it is a lot more relaxing. Especially as you get older, you just become more comfortable in the on set. You come, you're more comfortable with the tools, and you've just been down the road so many times. You specifically, I mean, literally thousands of times, that the actual filmmaking process doesn't intimidate you at all and doesn't bother you. No. It's not stressful anymore, as much as it was when you first did it.
Yeah, big crews and big things and big jobs, they don't. It's very just day-to-day now. So, yeah, walking into this film, I didn't need 200 crew like a lot of people have on their sets. We kept it very sort of manageable, and because I was paying for it, obviously. But it became a very easy set. Like there was no pressure on anyone, actually. Other than the actors, I really made sure the actors, you know, were really on their A game, and they were. I mean, I wanted not to shoot in some luxurious, the back of some resort. You know, we literally went to the Golden Triangle where this movie is set, and we really put the actors in the real Golden Triangle in a real village in
Cambodia.
Bush in Cambodia where this thing's set. So for performances from those actors, they literally went full on Lord of the Flies. It was awesome. The actors were great. I mean, I was so – actually, that was the saving grace, that all the actors in the film were just top-notch. Like they really, really put their all into it. Like,
because and I've had this experience as well with visual effects, a lot of times the actors don't know what it's going to look like at the end. And you could tell them, you know, and I'm sure there was like, you know, guys in suits and, you know, weird things going on and you're shooting – like they don't see it. I'm sure their reaction when they actually saw the film – they must have been godsmacked.
Yeah, it blew their minds. Like, I remember this one of the young actresses, she said to me, you know, she goes, "Oh, this is, you know, one of them B-grade shitty, crappy little movies that you do, right? It's part of your career jump." And because he's just watching this guy running around in a spandex suit, you know, pretending to be a robot. And you know, she didn't feel it, right? But she was acting top notch. I thought she was probably thinking, "I'm going to save the day here with my amazing acting." But when she saw the finished film, my God, she was like just gobsmacked. She was like, "Oh my goodness, I'm part of a real movie, like a proper movie, like a, you know, it's these actors are really going to." And I hope they do. Is they're going to really use this movie to jumpstart their careers even more? I hope. They're fantastic.
Can you tell everybody what the movie's about?
Well, it's actually a few things, because I didn't want just one story following one group of people or one person. So I've actually got about four, maybe five story arcs in it, and you follow certain characters through their scenes or, you know, through the movie. But the core of it is a CIA, a corrupt CIA agent with a robots manufacturing guy have decided to try and sneak their way into some military contract, but they need to do a couple of illegal tests of these robots to see if it'll really work before this guy presents it, you know, to the military to sell. And shit goes wrong, as it normally does. Another thing too is we've got another angle there where there's a whole bunch of young doctors that just happen to be doing immunizations where they dropped this robot or these robots into this village to test on, and the doctors actually you know see this crime really of these robots murdering this village. And then within there, we've got a tech group that's part of the whole robot team, which were sort of lied to. They said they were just doing a surveillance type test, but now it becomes like a huge murder mission. And these technicians don't really want to be a part of it either. They just think it's wrong. And also we've got, you know, I don't go too deep. There's two more story strands in there which are really, really strong as well. About, you know, a young boy in there that loses his parents, and he's got to survive in this mess as well with a Navy SEAL that's an AWOL Navy SEAL that's in there as well that just happened to be hiding away in one of these villages that doesn't want to be found, and there's a relationship there that builds quite nicely as well, but it is quite a bit going on, and that's what's made the movie quite appealing to our audiences that have seen it so far. And a lot of these big producers that have watched it, it's not just a robot movie going around killing people. It's actually this drama. It's quite deep. So yeah, I just didn't want it to be too simple a movie.
And definitely it is not a simple movie. That's for sure. So the thing I love about what really is terrifying about the robots is the design of the robots are kind of similar to real robots that they're testing out there right now in military. Cause I've seen some of these, you know, military robots that they're testing out there right now that they can walk upright, and if they, you know, you can push them, you can knock them down, but they get back up, and they have a similar design, which is more terrifying because, oh my, it's not like this out of this world, like, you know, oh, this could never actually happen. No, this is really, I don't know if you did that on purpose or not, but the design is similar to what I've seen just on the internet, you know, with, you know, these kind of robots. Was that intentional?
Yeah. I wanted it to be a bit more current day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with Boston Dynamics building those particular robots that are sort of rolling around on the ground and all that sort of stuff, I go, well, what's the next generation past that? You know, mm-hmm. Will it be ours? You know what I mean? They're a little bit more robust, a little bit more solid, you know, something that can take bullets, you know, explosions, something that's tough and strong, heavy and crazy and intimidating and all that. So I just thought, well, let's just step it up. And because I'm from an engineering type background, I really got into the whole mechanics of it, because I used to work on a lot of robotics and pneumatics and mm-hmm. and stuff in my early days, so I knew all about what, you know, servos do and hydraulic junctions and so forth. So when we were designing the robot with a really clever dude from Russia, he had this Russian flair, you know, it was all very industrial, and I really liked his style, but he really didn't understand. I had to follow a human underneath. So it really, we really needed not to have arms clashing and legs clashing, like when it did things, or the shoulder clashing with the chest.
Right.
So we really had to figure out a design, and I was literally sending him over all these real components or images of real mechanical components that we had to use for shoulders and elbows. So then he would then design something similar that would literally work for real. So that's what made the robot so quite real looking, is because we were really using all design styles from real actual machinery that would work for real if this thing was legit. And I didn't have the money to ring up Weta and get a $1 million robot made up. So and people, you know, like, then I thought, well, we're going to have to make this thing super high poly, because I wanted to do close-ups in 4K.
Right.
Close-up portraits. And from our advertising days, we did it all the time, but these 3D models get so large and so big and so heavy, you know.
Computer, yeah.
Perspective. Yeah. So we really had to design these things, and so many of them too, through the stages of the movie, to where they could handle a 4K camera right in their face and down to the point of, you know, where you can see fingerprints on the steel, you know, when you touch metal.
Yeah. How did you handle the technical challenges? I mean, that I know what that takes. That is a massive amount of data.
It's a lot of data, but what saved us actually was a program called Redshift, and we had all these big PCs made up with a lot of rendering power just to render these things out. Most of my work was all done on Macs, obviously, but that particular job of rendering it out was all PC based because we just needed these big video cards at the time to do that. But Redshift really saved us, and we were doing massive renders which were not taking long at all. So and the compositing I did a fair bit as well with one of my special effects guys, Ray Ortig, and we literally, between him and I, we did all the comping of over hundreds and hundreds of shots ourselves. I was just doing it in my spare time. He was on it full time.
How long did this take? How long did this movie take from conception to final?
Technically it was finished, probably a year ago, because we went through that traditional sales route. So I sort of blew a year just in that. So, but the movie's literally been up and from the moment I thought about it in the back of that van till, you know, I've got a finished hard drive with a movie on it, probably 3.5 years.
And you were just doing it basically as a side hustle.
Well, I shot the movie properly.
Sure, of course.
But really, you know, post-production, like editing, I just had to go back and do my day job, my real job. So I was just editing in my spare time while I was on airplanes, in hotel rooms, wherever I was at the time, on holidays, the weekends. But that, again, that was therapy too, editing the film for me. I loved it. Commercials day in, day out, all my own commercials. But to edit the film, it was so relaxing. It was great to see a scene unfold. And because I shoot multiple cameras as well, so we shot the movie with, you know, 4 and 5 cameras or 4 cameras mainly. And it's great for actors. You know, the actors really got into the multi-camera shooting, because then they could – it was like theatre, right? We just go – we blocked out the scene amazingly, and we just – our coverage was second to none. We just really, really nailed everything. And it was performances off camera that you would never normally shoot. But having 4 cameras, you got it. So we had so much extra filler and reactions.
And you shot what, red?
Yeah, we shot everything with red, yes.
What was the resolution you shot at?
8K, yeah.
You shot it at 8K.
Oh, no, 6K, because we had some dragons at the time as well. And Jared from Red sent us a new, one of the latest heliums as well, so which saved us in the cave scenes, that's for sure.
Really, because of the light sensitivity?
We got into a cave system in Cambodia, which is crazy. Like when you, I'll send you the film for a bit of a look, but you'll. Oh, I think we.
No, there. No, we're good.
No. You'll see some amazing cave scenes in there, and I wanted to use the most minimal of light in this cave, because when I walked into the cave, there were like shafts of light coming through little holes and all that sort of stuff. So our fill lights were very minimal because I wanted to keep the natural ambience of that cave coming through.
Right.
But when you see it, it all makes sense.
So you were the cinematographer as well? Yes. So you were the DP, the cinematographer, you were the DP, the director, the producer, and the editor, and also VFX supervisor, I'm assuming, as well.
On set I was, but I gave that role to another guy when I got home, because I sort of was too busy with other things to be I suppose I was the VFX super on the whole job, because everything literally had to come back through me. And, you know, what really, really saved us as well was a program or an app called Frame.io.
Yes.
And we were farming, you know, hundreds and hundreds of shots around the world to certain companies, you know, for rotoscoping, for animation, for motion tracking, for paint outs, for everything, right? So a lot of that little rats and micey type work got sent off around the world, and everything came back to him on my phone. So while I'm set, I'm looking at my movie on my phone and go and click OK. And I had a system going with all the post people. When you see the green approve button, you can bill me, right? So they loved it. They couldn't wait to see that little green button, approve button, pop up. So another thing too, I was pretty hard on the VFX guys because I didn't want to muck around too long with approval processes. And, you know, people tend to hire the cheap guys, but you shouldn't. You should hire the very expensive, experienced guys because they become cheaper overall because they can do a shot in maybe one day where the cheap guy takes 4 days. All of a sudden the cheap guy becomes more expensive than the right. expensive guy, you know what I mean? So myself, I'm very, you know, knowledgeable in visual effects anyway, so I chose pretty quickly who was doing well and who wasn't. So you had to sort of be on your A game a bit for this movie because I wanted it to be, you know, ILM type quality or, you know, top shelf. I didn't want it to be cheap.
Yeah,
and the movie was resting on good effects as well. You know?
The thing that I want people listening to understand is, and I've been saying this for a long time, the reason why you were able to make a film like this is because of all the tools you've put in your toolbox over the course of your career. And without those tools, you would have had to hire a cinematographer, you would have had to hire an editor, you would have to hire all these other, and this film doesn't become, it's not feasible anymore. And I do something similar in my world. All the stuff that I've been able to do, I do it because of all the tools I put in my toolbox. Can you please express to the audience how important it is to, even if you don't add those specific skills to your toolbox, to understand enough, like what you just said, I understood enough about VFX to know who was doing a good job and who wasn't doing a good job. And that saved you probably thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in the end. So can you just express how important that is to the audience?
That will vary, yeah. I like to mentor a lot of young filmmakers, and this film actually is going to be used as an experiment for them as well. But I've always tried to push a lot of filmmakers to learn as much as they can. And, you know, like from a program point of view, I went through, you know, my first program I've learned was Photoshop, and then I went to, you know, Avid, and then Final Cut Pro 7, and then Premiere, then FCPX, then Resolve, then, you know, as from editing programs go, compositing programs, you know, I started on like After Effects, then I jumped on the Flame, then we went to Nuke, then I tried Motion, I tried Fusion, you know, I've given them all a really good go, but you don't want to be like a part-time learner of them. You really want to get deep into every one of them so you really understand how to, you know, to write code, script, everything, so you really can get the best from each of those programs. And then you can figure out what's going to be fast and time-saving for you, because the more time you have, you know, in finding the right program that's fast, that delivers a quality thing, you can then put that spare time into your creative finishing. You know what I mean? So it's but learning all those programs for me was hugely beneficial, and especially 3D. I mean, I'm not a great in 3D because you need to be, as a 3D artist, you need to be in 3D all the time. It's like flying a helicopter, right?
Yeah, right.
Every time they change, like Maya, for instance, a new update would come and you'd go, oh, no. And because I wasn't in there enough, I just literally lost my way with Maya. And like Cinema 4D is like really easy. You know, there's a lot of great 3D programs out there you can get a hold of. I want to wrap my head around Unreal, when all this movie's out of the way and done. But there's a whole world of technology out there that can really benefit your filmmaking forevermore. And it makes making movies so much easier. So, in fact, like we were getting quotations for our film in its current guise, right, between $2 and $5 million for post-production. And really we got it down to using all outsourced freelancers as well as us doing stuff, but we managed to keep the price of it down to $350,000.
For all the VFX of this film?
All of the VFX of the film, of real cash. I'm not counting my labor that I
– You can't. Well, you can't count your labor because it's astronomical.
Right? But the reality is, you know, to save several million dollars by understanding post-production yourself, mm-hmm. that's you're getting into indie filmmaking, because the secret of making movies future forward is trying to – Who can make the best movie for the least amount of money
right.
is going to win this race. You know what I mean? And that's why I've had a lot of movie offers in the last sort of 6 months. There's a lot of producers out there going, oh, my goodness, you made that for how much? So all these producers are now, you know, calling me up crazily now, trying to get me onto their films because they know that's what they have to do as well. And, you know, a lot of them, there's a lot of producers really that just survive on the producers' offsets and all that. They don't care if the movie bombs or not, right? They just live off those offsets. But there's other producers out there, they go, no, we literally want a high-quality film and we don't want to spend the tens of millions or hundreds of millions that we normally do. Yeah. So having someone like me on the side really is really beneficial for them, obviously.
Yeah, and the way the marketplace is right now, you can't do what they – you know, you can't make a movie like you did 5 or 10 years ago because the marketplace is so changed that the value of the actual movie is diminished, and it's continuing to diminish every year that goes by as far as just like what's the actual value of the film. A film like yours in 2005 would have sold for $10, $15 million comfortably, probably purely because of what it is and how you built it. But in today's world, it's just a tougher sell. It's a really tougher sell. And everybody in Hollywood is feeling that kind of pinch that you have to create high quality product at a low budget. And if you could do that, you will work. You will work. And your film is definitely a calling card for that without question.
Yeah, I think I have no idea if I'm going to do well or not because, you know, we're not selling it through the traditional means.
Well, yeah, so let's get into that a little bit. So, all right, so you spent a year out there in the traditional sales, you know, going to sales agents, going to film distributors. And when I saw the film, I knew, like, you must have gotten some offers. You must have gotten some serious offers from some serious distributors because of the quality of the film. Because, I get bombarded with independent film on a daily basis. I see a lot of stuff. When I saw your film, it definitely stood out. And I'm sure most distributors who saw it, they go, oh, we can sell this everywhere in the world comfortably and make a lot of money with it. So what was your experience going down the traditional film distribution path?
It was good and bad. We hooked up with we hooked up with CAA, actually.
Okay.
As a company, they were good. They did all the right things from their side. You know, they introduced me to all the right people and they put the movie in front of all the right distributors and studios and all that sort of stuff. But the reality is, you know, you were right. The market is completely congested with content. You know, you go to these film festivals and you find out there's 25,000 feature film submissions.
To Sundance, yeah. Sundance was, I think, 22,000 or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and there's – in Cannes is the same and Toronto's the same. And then you look at the end of these festivals and it's all a dismal failure, right? They go, oh, only one film sold for $1 million or some crap like that. You go, oh, my God, yeah. It's just that, like, you know, I literally made my movie 3 years too late. And everyone was telling me, oh, you should have been here – 2 years ago, you made like pens. You know, it was all that shit. You know, you should have been here. You know, the typical surfer story, right? You should have been here yesterday. The waves are amazing. You know?
Exactly.
And, you know, and I'm listening to a whole bunch of people that are like AFM and Toronto. You know, other filmmaker friends I have, and they said, "Oh fuck, it was a bloodbath."
Yeah.
You know, it's like, fucking hell, we got offered like peanuts for our film, and then it sort of resonated with us with. The guys from CAA, you know, so they were trying their best. They did everything that they did right, I'm assuming and hoping. And pardon me. But you know, it's not their fault that the market was rubbish, you know what I mean? It's and the thing was, you know, distributors aren't buying one movie now for $5 million or, you know, trying to get you to sell a movie for $5 or $10 million. They're now going to offer you $15,000 or $20,000 or $50,000 for your film. And, you know, we did get some big seven-figure offers for our movie, but the contracts attached are so convoluted and the payment plans are so long-winded and it's too much of a process. Now, this is where COVID might have saved me or not from myself, but – put it this way, if COVID didn't happen, I probably would have sold the movie this way.
And just get it out there.
Offers and just went, whatever, I'll get my money back, walk away. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That was fun, done. But the reality is COVID hit and I'm sitting there going, Alex Ferrari, India. You know, I'm at home, I'm eating too much, I'm watching too much crap on the internet, I'm watching too many movies, and I've got time in my hands, and I went, fuck it. I'm going to sell this myself. Because at the end of the day, these distributors really are just going to dump my movie on all these TVODs and SVODs and AVOD platforms around the world over the next 10, 20 years, and they're going to make money off my movie, which is fine. That's what they do. But I was just thinking, well, since I've got all this time on my hands, I might as well just do exactly that myself. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah. And I remember when you called me, like, Alex, I read your book and it's completely screwed me up because I was going to go one way and now I'm like, and we started really talking about how we could do what you could do with this film. And, you know, we started brainstorming and how to do it because your film is, we were talking about this before we came on air. The film specifically is a little broad. It's not like a niche film. Like it's about, you know, a specific segment of the population or a religious or political or something that you can like sink your teeth into. But what it does have is that it's so effing cool. And it stands out purely because of the visuals, because you don't, you know what it is? It's an original tentpole film. In my opinion, it's an original studio film at an indie budget. And that is something. And it doesn't have any, I mean, you have some great actors in it, but you don't have any major movie stars in. You have any bank, you know, Will Smith's not running around, in this. So it's not the star power behind it. The star is the robots and the action and the visuals of it. And that's so rare because to be impressed by visual effects or to be impressed by a concept is such a rarity in film in general because studios do that all the time. They'll dump $100 million in visual effects and the movie will bomb. It won't even see the light of day. But yet you were able to create something that, I mean, captures people's imaginations. And like you said, it's timely. The where it's being shot, how it's being shot. I think that's what makes this film such an amazing experiment for the Filmtrepreneur method. Because you're just like, well, screw it. Let's just do this. And that's what I love about you, Mark. You were just like, I'm going to turn down 7 figures. I don't care. I'm just going to do this now because now it's principle. I'm going to do this myself.
Yeah, look, I'm not doing it to wreck the system because
– No, of course not.
You know, a lot of people won't do what I'm doing because they're just either too lazy or it's too much work, too much effort, whatever. But
no, and there's investors and there's other things like that. You have a very unique situation.
Yeah, I've got a unique situation and, you know, the traditional way is there. It's there. Don't expect to make much money that way.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to sell your indie film or if anything, the whole back end thing is really a myth. You probably won't see anything. You know, the realities are, you know, if you're going to hand over your movie to this guy to sell it on your behalf, he wants to make money as well, or he or she that the distributor wants to make some dosh. They're not going to sell you a movie for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've got mouths to feed, staff to feed, kids to send to school as well. So the distributor doing that on your behalf, he's not your buddy. He's just trying to make a few bucks off you. And the reality is your movie's not going to make a ton of money anyway. So there's not much to give around.
Right.
And, you know, like the whole theatrical thing, people go, oh, I can't wait for this to go to the movies. Like, oh, sadly, it's not going to go to the theaters. And they go, why? And I said, well, the problem with that is everyone but me will make money. So,
right.
You know, like that's a whole different beast again. You know what I mean?
So you're not planning. I mean, obviously, because of COVID, it's a different, and I'm not sure how it is in Australia right now.
Yeah. I don't know a single person. I know a lot of film directors, a lot of producers that have made movies. I mean, hundreds of movies. And we always have this chat. And theatrical distribution has been a dead duck for many, many years for all of them. Mm-hmm. They sort of use it almost like an ad to try and sell their movie. That's about the only purpose it has. Mm-hmm. The cinema owner makes the money. The distributor makes money off those theatrical deals. But the actual guy that made the film, paid for the film, made the film, they don't really get a hell of a lot from it. So that's why I decided not to worry about theatrical so much. And I'm, you know, now I'm looking at like Mulan and, you know, Greyhound and mm-hmm. What's that movie that just came out? I just watched the other night. I don't know. I think it was Mulan. But Trolls, you know, they're all just going straight to
Premium VOD. PVOD, as they're calling it, Premium Video on Demand.
Call it right. And they're just and they're making bank. And they're not even worrying about that theatrical release anymore. And I think that's probably
Yeah, we're here. We're good.
Yeah, it's probably the way to go moving forward. I mean, I've got a theater in my house. It's lucky I can watch it in the theater at any time. But it's
well, a lot of people have their own home theaters. You know,
so many people have amazing TVs and theaters in their home now, and they're so used to being locked out from theaters during COVID. It's I love watching movies on my iPad right now. Literally sitting on my chest with my Bose headphones on. Mm-hmm. The quality of the image that you never see in a cinema is just remarkable. I watched Interstellar the other night just on my iPad. I'm going, oh my god, there's so many colors and tones and things I've never seen before. You know, because I've not watched it on a proper monitor. It's literally just been on these big giant projectors,
which Mr. Nolan must be rolling over right now if he hears this.
There's a lot of amazing movies that I'm rewatching. Yeah. You know, I've got these Apple 6K monitors, and I've been watching people's movies on these monitors or on my 8K TV, right? Mm-hmm. And you go, wow, I've never seen the movie look so good before. So, and I'm really enjoying the movie experience now with all these latest TVs. So, still cool though. I would have loved my movie to do the theatrical thing, but the reality
COVID is a little rough. I personally think you could have done, you probably would have done well if you did a four-walling or booking the theaters yourself theatrically. That might have done well because I know a lot of case studies and experience and filmmakers who do well with that. Your film probably would have been a good candidate for just calling up a movie theater and going, hey, do you want to book my film? I promise you they'll book it and see what would happen. And you would get a 50-50 split with a theater. So that could have done well. But with COVID as well, it's a whole other conversation right now. And it would be different.
Beast, yeah.
It's a completely different beast.
I've had some cinema owners ring us for the film.
I'm sure.
I went and saw Tenet the other night at the cinema with my son, and we were the only people sitting in the theater, you know.
Right.
It was, I go, well, you know. Anyway, but that's COVID times. So, you know, the next movie I do, if I do another movie, I might rethink. I think you just got to flex with the time, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not like, you know, when, you know, as you and I have been coming up over the years, before it was pretty rock solid, the process. You made a movie on film. You made a print, you went to the theater, then it went to home video, but that was the process. And it stayed like that for a long time. But now it changes monthly. Like it's like PVOD was not a thing in January. Like in January, premium video on demand really was not a thing, not a serious thing at least. But now it's been forced to be a serious thing. And, you know, all of the things have changed because of not only COVID, but just generally the marketplace. It's remarkable. Now, how are you applying the Filmtrepreneur method to the film? What are your plans with it? I know you're doing an Indiegogo. What revenue streams are you planning to build for the film?
Probably not as detailed or as vast as what you've recommended, because mm-hmm. I've decided it's hard to focus on 10 things well. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So I'm going to focus on two or three things well.
Fair.
And the biggest one is for any movie sitting on a shelf, a digital shelf, is you have to sell it. Right? You've got to get it out there to the world. And hence that's where the Indiegogo thing is sort of, you know, my wife doesn't want to keep dipping her hand in the bank book the whole time. you know, or our money, it's ours, but you know what I mean? It's COVID time, so we've got to be a little bit frugal. Mm-hmm. So marketing the film is a big deal for me. And since I'm from an advertising industry of 25 years, I've literally been armed to the teeth with good marketing knowledge. You know, I've been literally taught by the best of the best from the biggest companies in the world, and they've all taught me really how to sell my movie at one point, with inadvertently, right? So, and so far, believe it or not, we've had an unbelievable trailer launch. Mm-hmm. I literally look at YouTube. I've got like right now, I'm just looking at my big screen here, and I've got like there's about 50 movies on this YouTube page, and we have got next to, I think, June, the movie June that just come out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's it. And we are actually the biggest play trailer in next to June. We've even beaten Batman on this one particular giant website. So, you know, we're at like almost 850,000 views, and Batman is 800,000. So we've beat Batman by 50,000 views, and that's only on one YouTube site. So, you know, the good thing about YouTubers is they're looking for revenue from YouTube. They just steal your trailer and put it up on their website. But mm-hmm. they're serving us a great
service
because they're literally getting us all this amazing free advertising. And my movie's just literally, it's out there. We sort of lost count at 7 million-ish. And it's
very quickly, too. Within 30 days, no?
No, it's only been out. Oh, yeah, it's just hit 30 days now. So it's not even that. It's 24 days. But, yeah, it's crazy. It's I was hoping for maybe in total maybe a couple hundred thousand views. But to get into the millions, like that's tentpole stuff, right?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's
I'm very, very happy, obviously. Very happy with that. And I think we contributed down. We teamed up with a PR company in LA, which helped pushed out as well simultaneously. So they were the kindling, you know, and all the social stuff was the fire, and it took off. And, you know, and social media, you can't even count social media because so many people have shared it. I have no idea what the numbers are there. And we've paid a little bit in social media to push it, but really that's just a small amount of money, really, because we just want to understand our market and who's really hitting on this thing. And mm-hmm. we found out that, you know, men or males between 25 to 35 is our biggest market. So, and it's, you know, fans in so many different genres too, the horror genres. So the good thing about good analytics is from especially Facebook is you really get to dig deep into who's really looking at your movie. Mm-hmm. And so our targeted advertising come December when we actually release the film is going to be pretty intense. And sorry if I'm going to bombard you with more advertising. But
oh, no. There'll be plenty of it, and I will be the tribe will know about the film. I am going to be promoting it fairly heavily as well. And I will be putting the trailer up very soon on Indie Film Hustle's YouTube. As well. Now you also, so you have, you know, you have merch that you're creating for the project, which looks so cool that I'm like, I need a t-shirt, Mark. So you need to make this happen. So, you've got merch, which is going to be great. And I think merch just on itself, regardless of the film, it's cool. It's just a cool looking t-shirt. That it's associated with the project is another thing. So that is a revenue stream that you can keep going with. And then now you also have created a massive online business, like an online course, or almost like behind the scenes of this film.
Yeah, so yeah, well, really, that's just an Indiegogo thing to help us with. You know, the money from Indiegogo is literally just going to get funneled straight back into our second wave advertising. You know, when we release, mm-hmm. The videos really are just that they're the most. I really want to share them. Really, the way we did this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Because we've broken lots of rules. We've done everything apparently the wrong way. We've shot a big movie with a minimal crew. We've done big post-production with a minimal team. We've done lots of things that are not normal, the way we've done everything, including the marketing and self-distribution. So I really want to share that because there's a lot of a lot of young filmmakers out there that really want to make a movie. And I'm going, well, you know, you're a great asset for that community. Now, if people have a little bit more, you know, money and can find a little bit more, here's another way of going even bigger again. Instead of it being the vegan chef, you know, a quiet little movie, if you want to make a big genre action thriller, you can actually do that. But there's these processes you need to do it. You know what I mean?
And no, I'm excited.
I really want to share those the way we did it, and you know, a few people that you should possibly ring, because there's a lot of people in all these countries around the world. They think they're overcharging you, but it's actually like 1/10 the price you normally pay in the Western world. You know what I mean? And they do such a good job. I pay them even a little bit more, you know, because there's no way I could have got a local guy to do that job for that money. And even the local post companies here in Australia and America, everywhere, they send all their work offshore.
Right.
So it's all about finding these artists around the world to really jump in. And the secret of that is you pay them fast and you pay them well. Don't rip them off. You know, they'll do a great job if you look after them, every one of them. But when it comes to that high-end stuff, it's I always bring in the right people. You know, I brought in a great first AD, camera operators. You got to don't bring in the wrong people to help you make that film, because it'll become painful.
Yeah, penny wise, pound foolish, essentially.
Yeah. Because I didn't want to, I wanted to do it. I wanted to make this movie student film style without the students. You know what I mean? So I didn't want all that chaos that goes with student films. I wanted order and preciseness and effectiveness. But I couldn't afford to have any circus going on in the background.
Are you planning to release a Blu-ray? Because it is a 4K print. You have a 4K master of this, so it seems a perfect candidate for a Blu-ray release.
Yeah, look, there is a company I'm going to team up with for that, because I'm not sure I can be bothered with doing all that DVD stuff myself. But there will be at the time, and I'm sure that's going to all release at the time. T-shirts, you got me going. That I think might have been on your show or someone else's, but they said they made about $300,000 from selling their movie and $900,000 in T-shirt sales.
Oh, yeah.
Something like that. And I'm like, yeah, let's do the T-shirts. You know?
You should absolutely do the T-shirts. You're leaving money on the table if you don't do stuff like that. I mean,
I'm getting emails like every second day for a T-shirt. And I'm going, God, come on, T-shirt company, you know.
Yeah.
But this COVID slowed down the whole T-shirt system. But it's, you know, anyway, we've got it going. We've got some samples finally coming to us shortly, and it's, you know, we will advertise that. We're not just going to dump it on our webpage and hope for the best. We will literally push that,
right?
You know, all of those things, and that's all part of that revenue making. There's companies that have rung us up for toys and
yes,
and you know, because these robots make, and again, I don't know how many people have called me. Go, are you making
Okay, so first of all, I'm gonna throw this all out there. So I'm gonna just give you all these ideas right now. Okay, first of all, you absolutely need to be targeting the comic book, you know, geekdom world, the nerd world, because this film is built for comic cons. It's like built for that kind of world as well as all the other niches. So if you create maquettes for this and you call up Sideshow or you call up one of these companies and partner with them on creating, and there's tons, by the way, and you don't have to, not only the big boys, but you could also find smaller companies who would be willing to, you know, license this from you all day. Action figures, toys, all day you should be able to create, because again, that there's a movie attached to it is helpful, but just the design of the robots is so darn cool. And the things that you can build around that world, you can build an entire ecosystem of a world around just these robots and what they're doing, and the whole comic books, graphic novels, all day you could be building. There's, you really could be doing, you could be making a lot of money with this project if you start venturing out into all these other areas. Because it's just the perfect candidate for it. Not every film could do that. Like on the corner of Ego and Desire, not so much with the toys. You know, not so much for the filmmaking. Though I would love to see some action figures of the filmmakers trying to sell their movie at Sundance. But this is a perfect, perfect candidate for that entire world to do. And I think you'd be foolish. You'd be leaving a lot of money on the table if you don't start going down there. And it's, again, doesn't have to be that you physically are doing it. You can actually partner with these companies and get a royalty check and just get royalty checks on this stuff.
I'm looking at this already. It's the, you know, I'm a little bit time poor because I've got so many other things going on, but I will be investigating and doing it further. That's for sure. It's, you know, we've already had, you know, people go, oh, are you doing a sequel? I'm going, geez, mate, the movie's not even out yet, right?
No, people but,
you know,
are.
The movies work for us in a whole other way. You know, from a revenue point of view, it will, you know, I've literally, this is part of the experiment. The experiment was, I'll go and make a movie, I'll sell it, I'll do everything, and we'll just see if it's actually a feasible thing. Because, you know, like you said, I know, you know, hundreds and hundreds of directors and producers that have made movies, and a very, very small percentage of them actually have made okay money from them. Most mm-hmm. of them will pull a bit of a wage out of them, but that's about it. Mm-hmm. So I've got a few people doing Netflix shows at the moment, all my friends, and they, you know, that's they make their wage. Mm-hmm. That's all they make.
They're hired guns.
No one's making bank, right? They're literally making their own jobs. You know what I mean? And so I'm going down this route, going, all right, if I make a movie like this and I sell it like this, is it a feasible business model? You know, will I just keep making movies until I croak, or am I going to do other people's movies? And that's where, which I touched on a little bit earlier, is, you know, we've had like 30-odd movies sent to me, like literally the moment this trailer came out and beforehand, people wanted me to do their big movies, and some of them, one of them was, yeah, $180 million. Another one was like $120 million. Another one was $80 million. There's a few $50 million movies, and they're all big, big players. And it's great conversations. It's really good talking to these guys. So there's another way, you know, this movie as an experiment, was it a showreel piece for me, for my, you know,
abilities, talent.
Show people that I could do an actual movie. And anyway, all these people have seen the film. They all love it, and they just threw all these like one guy said, I was going to give you our little $2 million script, but can you check out this $50 million one instead, right? So it's a very lovely conversations. Now, whether these guys, you know, they're all spinning plates, they're all trying to align moons, I have no idea if they're going to get their movies up or not. And they're all credible big players, and they have made hundreds of movies. And but I think this day and age with COVID, who knows? I could be sitting on a, you know, movie set next year, you know, blowing stuff up, or I could be just doing my own movies, or I could be back to doing TV ads. I have no idea.
So, and that's another thing I really stress in the Filmtrepreneur method, is that it doesn't always have to be about making the money back on the film. If you get a job or you get something else, like I did a short film that I did for $50,000, and I did not make $50,000 off that short film, but I got jobs as a director that easily paid for that over the course of the next few years. So it's all about the end game, with like where you want to go. And you are a brave soul willing to just, and you have the ability to do an experiment. And that's why I'm so fascinated with Monsters of Men, with you, how this all turns out. And that's why I'm going to keep the tribe very up to you. You will come back on the show if you want to come back and keep me updated on the going ons of what is going on with the film, because this is kind of a once in a lifetime experiment, because this doesn't happen, Mark. this is not something that happens. I'm sorry.
A lot of people are telling me that. And a lot of people are telling me you don't make movies like this. And that it is unique, and I am in a very fortunate position to do so. You know, my wife my wife said, just give it away for free on YouTube.
Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. If you're going to do that, call me.
But it's more like, I think, you know, she was thinking, I'll just jump on these big tent poles and just, you know, we'll get our money back that way, right?
Right.
But I don't really want to rely on other people too much. You know, I'm happy to go and jump on these big films. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Just go and do them. I think it'll be fun. But the reality is I can't rely on those people either, you know what I mean? You've got to literally rely on your own efforts.
And COVID right now has really exposed that. I think a lot of directors specifically, let's just talk about our people, directors specifically, I think they've come to the realization that like, oh, I literally am relying on my entire livelihood on getting clients, on getting gigs, on working for somebody else. And if those jobs dry up like they have during COVID, I'm screwed. As opposed to building your own business, building your own projects, building your own revenue streams, whereas you can survive with no jobs for indefinitely if you're able to build online businesses or build on other sort of businesses. Like you have a property business, you have other things that generate revenue that you're not going paycheck to paycheck. And I know a lot of directors and a lot of filmmakers out there who were doing well, but then when you can't shoot, this is an unheard of situation, you're screwed. And it could be this way for another year, maybe two, before we get back up and running the way it is. How is it, by the way, in Australia? Like, how is the shooting scenario there?
It's quite messy here at the moment. I mean, there's work floating around. It's actually quite busy, but it's – a lot of it's
– but you can shoot?
Yeah, I've been shooting. Yeah, we've just finished a nice big shoot. Okay. But the reality is it's very cost savings. Like this is my fourth recession technically I've gone through since I was a kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen this before. I've seen those $2 million Kellogg's cornflakes commercials get chopped down to $1 million and the next
or half a million.
They get 500 grand.
Yeah.
And the next recession they go to like 100 grand, you know, because There's always someone out there to chop it down. And the client goes, well, I'm happy with that. And I only paid $100,000. They'll never pay any more for that commercial ever again. And I just did a big mistake with a client. I did a huge job for them, you know, a year ago, like in the millions. And this year they gave me sort of like $100,000 to do one, and it literally almost looks as good as the big $1 million one. But we did it really cheap wise, like we tiny crew and everything, but it looks amazing. But I think I've just wrecked that client too, because they've just gone, oh geez, well look what you just gave us for that much. So I doubt they'll ever give me any more money ever again.
Right.
So the reality is recessions literally destroy this type of industry, you know, and you've got to be clever in the figuring out how to try and make a buck out of it from this point forward. And as well, because of the digital industry, there's so many people are running around with an A7S and a camera and a tripod now that, you know, the competition's so fierce and everyone is happy to work for peanuts to try and push their career up. So it's a bit of a crazy industry. Right now, it's a very hard industry for the young people to really do well in it,
mm-hmm.
Unless they really, really work hard. I mean, me making movies again, I'm not sure if that's the way to go. I'll tell you in 6 to 8 months' time if it's a worthwhile thing to go along and do. But you know, it's not hard to make a living in the film industry. You just got to work for it.
And it's harder. It's harder now than it was.
Yeah. The days of sitting back just getting your one job a week, charging a week's wages for a day's work is now
gone.
I'd say officially dead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean,
because, you know, the film crew were getting – everyone gets paid way too much anyway.
Right.
You know, with lunches and dinners and everything brought to you on set. I mean, it's very privileged.
No, without question.
I don't want it to change. I want it to stay like that forever, but the reality is it's probably going to change dramatically.
Now, I think, Mark, that you have a very unique film, a very unique IP that you should be, and I know you will be, exploiting to the umpteenth degree of trying to generate revenue with it and building out this kind of film entrepreneurial model by doing it yourself, getting it out there into these marketplaces and generating that revenue. So I am very interested to see how this all goes. If the launch is any indication, I think you're going to do just fine.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Like I said, I like experiments like this, especially if they work. But so far, thing has gone to plan. I did go over budget on the movie, I should say. My wife will always, if she was standing in the room, you go, you went over budget. But the reality was, when we were shooting the film, I was going to do a bit like the movie The Quiet Place, you know, just see the robots, just, you know, they sort of come out at the end. But once I started shooting, I went, screw it. Let's have robots all through it. You know what I mean? So I literally, you know, the script changed all of a sudden on set. But, you know, it was our money. We could do that sort of stuff.
That's a very director thing to do. Like, you just, like, you know, I want to see more. Well, that's what, look, that was why Jaws is an absolute masterpiece, because he didn't get all the shark he wanted because it didn't work. But you had the ability to have as much shark as you want, sir.
Now, well, it didn't cost much more, so.
And I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Depends on what level you start in, but if you're trying to break into making content, whether it be movies or ads or anything, it all comes down to your body of work that you can show and market to the world. If you don't have a decent showreel, if you don't have a decent commercial showreel or a decent drama showreel, which you can do yourself, which you can go out and shoot fake commercials, you can go out and shoot fake ads and make short films and all that sort of stuff you can do yourself. All you need is a camera and a couple of lenses and some buddies and a lot of knowledge in post-production. So learn as many programs as you can to help. Those are your tools. You know, go and shoot amazing content, practice, 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 and then tell the world and show the world how good you are. Now, if your reel is good, people will call you. It's as simple as that. Like, my advertising showreel is very strong. I sort of make it like a montage thing up every 5 or 6 years. Every time I send that thing out, the phone rings off the hook. So it's all about building that body of work, but making sure you market to the planet. I get phone calls from Russia, everywhere in the world. Every corner of the world has called me to do a TV commercial because I've made myself highly visible. So,
very important. Marketing.
Yes. And the same thing would go for movies too, I'd say.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
The longest lesson? I don't know. I'm still learning. I don't know. Love your family to death. I don't know. It's all about my kids and my wife now. I'm sort of, you know, I'm this movie business for me at the moment is purely a hobby. But honestly, my family are everything to me now. My sort of, you know, where I used to be very one-sided, very committed and career, and now I'm like, you know what? And now my kids are all at home now, and now I don't want them to leave home. You know, I want them to be at home.
Isn't that the thing? As you get older, like when you're a kid, like when you're in your 20s and your 30s, you just like it's all about career. It's all about career, and you're focusing so much, and then as you get older, you get met, and you now family becomes more important. Like, you know, I don't want to be on the road. I'd rather just, you know, can I shoot something locally? Okay. Or can I shoot something quickly, you know, so I can stay home with family?
Yeah. COVID's been great. You know, my wife and I are like, my wife was, I'm not sure, she's a bit of a shock. I'm usually awake, you know, 7, 8, 10 months of the year.
Right.
Overseas filming. So for me to be home this much, it was like, it took us a bit to get adjusted to each other, right? And then and my kids, you know, I'm ringing them randomly at some stupid hour of the night. Hey, how you going? You know, like what's going on? Dad's been a pain in the neck, you know.
That's awesome. All right, and three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, there's so many. I mean, I actually a big fan of Cloud Atlas.
I love Cloud Atlas. Yeah.
Yes. I'm a big fan of there's so many great movies. Close Encounters of the Third Kind is one of my all-time favorites.
Mm-hmm.
The I think I was watching Interstellar the other night. I still think that's quite the masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
I do like big movies. I'm a Ridley Scott fan. I do actually love Michael Bay movies, but not real. I'm not really into the story so much, but I just
the visuals.
I'm amazed what he achieves on screen. You know, I'm a Chris Nolan fan and I'm a Spielberg fan. So it's, you know, those are four big directors. And what's his name? Villeneuve, the guy that's doing Dune, and he did Blade Runner as well, I think.
Dennis Melville. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I cannot say his last name. I just had his brother on the show. He just got released last week. And he's a director as well. He's a sci-fi director as well. He's a younger brother. Which is that must be a hell of a family to be in.
Yeah. I think he's doing all the jobs I'd love to do.
Are you and a lot of other directors in town, sir? So don't feel
like I was the biggest Dune fan in the world, and when I heard he was doing Dune, I'm like, oh no. Oh well, at least it went to someone awesome, right?
So, right, and that trailer looks insane. Insane. And I love Blade Runner. His Blade Runner was brilliant. I'm a huge fan of the first one. I mean, you watch that and you're just like, well, that's just a masterpiece.
It was so raw looking. It was the first of the raw movies, wasn't it? And mm-hmm. raw sky. I mean, yeah. You know, what gets is, you know, both of those movies are technically flops, right?
Right.
But they've got a cult following. And, you know, the last one was even a bigger flop. You know, it was a $100 million dump.
But it looked fantastic.
It's a beautifully made film. Go figure.
Exactly.
You know, this movie, right?
Now, and where can people find you and find out more about Monsters of Man?
It's monstersofman.movie.
Okay.
And that's it.
And that has
the dot thingamajig.
Gotcha.
Prefix. Monstersofman.movie. Yes. I think it is. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And everything. And Indiegogo's campaign still going on right now. I think you last I checked, you were over 140% funded already. So within a few days.
That went probably better than we thought as well. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's been great.
No, I mean, yeah, it's
and that money is literally going to go straight to the marketing of the film. So I'm really thankful to all the supporters, and there's a lot of people still buying it. So buying the perks and everything. So I'm very, very thankful to all those people.
Well, Mark, I want to not only thank you for being on the show, but thank you for doing this experiment, because it's going to put a lot of things to the test in regards to, like, well, if someone actually made a movie like Monsters of Man and did what you're doing, you know, to do an experiment like this is such a rare occasion that it happens. So I thank you for just saying, hell with it, I'm going to do it this way. And I know everyone's telling me not to do it. And I thank you for turning down, you know, a multiple seven figure distribution deals. And that's one thing I asked you when we talked a while ago, was like, why did you turn down that seven? He goes, oh man, because by the time I was going to get paid, I was going to be like 105 years old, like all the stuff that they were doing and payment schedule. It was just so shady. You're just like, screw it. I'm just going to do it myself.
Look, I wouldn't say it's shady. It's just the way they do things, right?
Right. Potato, potato, sir.
Yeah, those deals can – the delivery schedule is very difficult in them, and you've got to jump a lot of hurdles. And I think a lot of it's the delay purpose,
mm-hmm.
really. So, you know, that your movie's actually out, released, out to the world, and they still haven't paid you, right? So it's sort of like, you know, what they're doing is they're recouping – all your money out in the marketplace, and then they're just going to pay you what they owe you anyway. So they're not really putting any skin in the game at all. But that's the way distribution is. And you just, if you don't want to sell the movie yourself, you got to do it that way. But, you know, the proof that the whole thing that comes out of this is, from a film perspective, my movie will probably make less money doing it my way, mm-hmm. but I'll make more.
Right.
And if I did it through that way, it'll probably make more money, but I'll make less. Does it make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. That's going to go.
Well, Mark, thanks again for being.
Alex. You know, you've had a couple of, distributors on site. There was, I think it was Indie Rights. Indie Rights, you know, like she had the right idea, that lady, because she was like, you know, we'll charge you this, I'm not sure, 5%, 10%, 15%, whatever she does. But she seemed very open and transparent, and that's what's going to make her little business model take off, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And but she's literally just doing what we're sort of doing anyway.
On scale.
She's charging you for that, you know. And I think companies like that are the future. The transparency is a big deal, especially live portals. You know, one good thing about if you're doing Amazon and iTunes, you get the portal, you get to see everything. So you know that those sales, you know, distribution companies aren't touching up all these aggregators because you can see what they see, you know what I mean? Right. So it's all about transparency moving forward for a lot of people, I think.
Mark, thanks again for being on the show, and I wish you nothing but success with Monsters of Man, and I can't wait to see how it all turns out, sir. Thank you again, my friend.
It will fail or win, you'll know it all. I'll share with you another time.
Again, I cannot thank Mark enough for not only being on the show, but on going on this filmtrepreneur adventure to see if his film can actually get a great ROI. And from what we're already seeing early on, it's looking good. I think his film is, the filmtrepreneur method is very case by case. And I wanted to see if a film of his magnitude, with his budget, with no major bankable stars in it, is going to be able to do what we all think it can do. So I'm really curious. And Mark is going to come back on the show in the next 6 to 12 months and let us know how it's going. See what worked, what didn't work. And you guys, the tribe, will be able to benefit from this insane experiment. Thank you again, Mark. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including watching this insane trailer of Monsters of Men, head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/067. Thank you for listening, guys. As always, be that filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.